I'd like to go ahead and call the meeting to order. It's January 30th, 2020. I'd like to remind everybody to turn their cell phones off. We don't not have a quorum, but we're going to get rolling. It's 9 a.m. after 9 a.m. We'll be joined here shortly by a few other members. With me today is Senator Olson and Senator Wilikowski. We do now have a quorum, Senator Bishop, so we're official. Please try to silence your cell phones, so on and so forth. And we've got a presentation today from Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. We're going to go over the financial position, some budget highlights, 21 budget highlights, talk about some current issues, where the trust feels are headed, and take any questions from committee members that they may have. We have with us today to do the presentation, Mr. Mike Abbott, who's been here before. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the Trust, and he's got a lifeline with him. Mary Jane Mitchell, is that right?
Michael,
Board Chair. So I'll let, like to have the Mr. Abbott start off, and then he could lifeline over to the board chairman whenever necessary. And then maybe, well, I guess we don't have the camera on for people at home, so you won't have to explain your history and work history and stuff for the public, because there's probably not going to be that many watching today. So we'll skip that and just start the presentation. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's great to be back with you here today to talk about the Mental Health Trust. I'm grateful to be joined by our board chair, Mary Jane Michael. She'll start off our presentation, and then I'll go into the guts of our finances, our trust land office activity, and our FY21 budget proposal.
Okay, and maybe before we get rolling, Madam Chairman, you have some board members with you. Would you like to read them off for the committee members?
So yes, I'd like to introduce them to you, Mr. Chairman. Chris Cook, who's the vice chair, Ken McCarty, who's the secretary, Verne Berner, program and planning committee chair, Lorraine Durr, finance committee chair, Anita Halterman, audit and risk committee chair, and John Sturgeon, resource management committee chair. Also in the audience today is our most recent appointee from the governor, Rhonda Bowles from Fairbanks.
Okay. That sounds good. That takes care of slide number two. And before you start, we are being joined by Senator Hoffman. Go ahead and continue.
Just to give you a little bit of background, I'll be brief because I realize most of you know who we are. This past fall, we celebrated our 25th anniversary of the landmark settlement that created the trust. The settlement was a significant moment in Alaska's history, and over the last 25 years, the trust has increased its assets and served thousands of beneficiaries who experience mental illness, developmental disabilities, substance abuse disorders, Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and traumatic brain injuries. The trust is the only organization of its kind in the United States. It is a state corporation that maintains a unique position in Alaska government. Our funds, similar to a private foundation, are self-generated and grant to projects, partnerships, and programs that promote long-term systematic change. I'll skip our history, but I do want to share with you that today our primary focus is on improving the psychiatric crisis continuum of care. The recent challenges at API highlight the gaps in community-based crisis intervention, which, if in place, can reduce the need for inpatient treatment for many beneficiaries. The Trust is working with DHSS and other community partners to look at national models that can be replicated in Alaska to reduce the need for long-term inpatient psychiatric care. And Mike's going to talk a little bit more about that in our presentation. Our land office continues to make significant progress. We are seeing the results of 10-plus years of work on the United States Forest Service Federal Land Exchange. The Icy Cape and Heavy Mineral Project continues exploration activities, finishing a sixth field session this summer. and the recent closed bid sale of the Juneau Subport property will generate a whopping $20 million for the trust and our beneficiaries. Not only does the trust land generate new revenue to add to the trust investment earnings, but it has been a stimulus for local economies and creating jobs. We have also invested in our internal organization. We've responded to the audit findings presented to you last year. We have also increased staff and trustee trainings, established committee charters and protocols. We've streamlined operations to get more grant funds to organizations serving beneficiaries and sooner. The trust has a remarkable group of dedicated and resourceful staff, and we have a strong leader and a board of trustees I've been proud to serve with. So with that, I'd just like to turn it over to Mike, and he'll jump right into the budget.
Okay, before we head off into the financials, we normally stop at the end of a slide for make sure I have questions from my committee men. And Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Stebbin. Chair Stebbin, good morning, ma'am.
Good morning.
My interest peaked when you were talking about looking at national standards or ideas on improving behavioral health and that's good, but and I'm really focused on substance use disorders. And are you limiting yourself to, when you say national, I mean North America, or are you looking internationally too at what's been done in Europe and other places to help in this area?
We've looked at one particular project, but we're going to, further along in the slides, we have a full presentation that will describe that for you. If you'd like us to talk to you about it now, we can, or when the slide comes up.
Well, let's do it when the slide comes up so we stay in order. I'd also like a little more information on the Icy Strait, potentials for the trust in Icy Straits. If it's, you know, later on in the presentation, fine. If not, you could talk about it now.
We'll get to that in just a couple of slides, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Any other questions from committeemen? We've been joined by Senate President Giesel also. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This slide describes the change in the scale of the trust's invested assets since just after we were formed. The trust was granted $200 million of funds during the settlement process in 1994. Since then, through a combination of investment earnings and deposits into the trust related to our land management activity and prudent stewardship from the trustees, our invested assets now are close to $700 million. That, in addition, that does not include, for instance, the soon-to-be-invested proceeds from the Subport sale, the two-acre parcel just down the hill from us here, which we recently announced the completion of a competitive sale on, and the trust will receive $20 million from Norwegian Cruise Lines for that parcel. That radically exceeded our expectations from that, and I'd love to be able to tell you that that was due to strong management leadership engagement, but we were in the market found us at the right time. I'd also like to tell you that we have a lot of other $20 million parcels coming on the market soon, and unfortunately we don't anticipate that at this time. But we expect that these invested assets will continue to grow over time. Again, through investment earnings, depositing investment earnings, and also from the proceeds from our land management activities, timber, minerals, oil and gas, and land sales and real estate.
Go ahead and continue.
So here's what that means for us in the current year. At the end of FY19, $650 million of invested assets was our total. $450 million of that is in our corpus. Those are funds that cannot be deployed. Those are invested for the long term. We also have $125 million of reserves. These are spendable. We hold them in a reserve status to protect the trust in the event of investment declines, so that we're still able to be active programmatic funders even if our investments do not perform well for a multi-year period. And then we also note here that our commercial real estate investments, the equity position in those has grown, and currently, well, at the end of FY19, was a little over $60 million. What that means for our current year funding is that the investment earnings will generate just a little less than $25 million that will help fund our FY21 spending. As you can see, that makes up the vast majority of our spending, and that in the income from our investments is growing at $1 to $2 million per year, so which directly leads to our spending capability. In addition to almost $25 million of investment earnings, we also have a little over $3 million of prior year carry forward. And then the land office activity generate the trust land office in managing our lands generates a little less than $5 million of spendable income that we will use in FY21. And then we also, on our cash accounts, we also generate some interest earnings from that as well. The net of that is $33 million, which we expect to deploy in FY21. And as you can see in the lower right-hand portion of the slide, that $33 million represents continued growth in our spendable income and our annual budgets for the last 5 years. And we expect that trend to continue. You should see continued growth in trust spending of $1 to $2 million a year based on reasonable expectations of performance of our investments and our land management activity.
Okay, do we have any questions on this slide? Could you talk to us a little bit about the real estate holdings? And we've had some concerns a while back that we're working through and dealing with those holdings. Can you give the committee an update of the status of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Many of you will recall that during about a 5.5 year period, starting in 2010, the trust acquired 7 commercial real estate properties for investment purposes. These were the funds that were used to acquire those assets were funds that could have been deployed into the Corpus account and invested with the Alaska Permanent Fund. That generated concerns, and particularly concerns expressed in the legislative audit that was completed in the summer of 2018. Since that, those concerns have been identified, the trust has taken a number of activities. First, no further real estate investments have been made. And we've committed that without explicit statutory authority, no further use of our investable funds will be used for that purpose until and unless there is statutory authority provided explicitly for that use. And we are not seeking that authority at this time. Second, the initial investment that the trust made in those properties, roughly $40 million, we have transferred from our reserves into the corpus that exact amount of funds. So we have, in essence, made the corpus of the Mental Health Trust Authority whole. And it now sits at the same level it would have been had had the real estate not been acquired and had those funds been deposited into the Mental Health Trust Fund, or the corpus, during that 2010 to 2016 timeframe. Third, we continue to hold the real estate, and it continues to perform very well for us. On this slide, you can see that we currently are expecting $4.7 million of spendable income from land office activities in FY21. Of that $4.7 million, $2 million of that are the net proceeds from the income from those commercial properties. So a significant percentage of the land office income and a significant percentage of our overall spending is sourced in that real estate investments. And then fourth, we have secured the services. Let me back up. One of the audit's recommendations was that we update our asset management policy statement, which is sort of the equivalent of an investment policy statement that you might see for a foundation or an endowment or some other portfolio. That IPS, or in our case, AMPS, guides our investment activity of all of our different investment classes. So we updated that. Callan came in. We piggybacked on Callan's contract with the Alaska Permanent Fund. They evaluated our AMPS, as they had done more than a decade ago, and they made recommendations for changes to that. Those changes were adopted unanimously in total by the trustees in 2019. One of the changes in our asset management policy statement was that if, in fact, the trust owned commercial real estate and the AMPS allows for that, then the trust should secure the services of an institutional real estate advisor, someone that is that works with portfolios such as the trust's to help them evaluate the merits of different real estate investment strategies. We went through a competitive process last fall and secured the services of Harvest International, a reputable firm with several billion dollars of assets that they advise on. And they are advising us. They have visited all seven of our properties by now. Well, excuse me, they have not visited the Alaska properties yet. Something about waiting until more appropriate weather for that. But they have visited our out-of-state investment properties, will visit our Alaska properties. And then they will begin to make recommendations to the trustees on the ultimate plans for those assets as part of our overall invested portfolio. So we will see that and we'll be happy to report on the results of their recommendations. We should see the first series of recommendations from them at our Finance Committee meeting in April of this year. And we'll be happy to report back to the committee, and we'll do this obviously in open session, we'll be talking about this with all of our stakeholders. Does that address any further questions?
Yes. Is there a sale pending?
There is. One of our tenants at one of our out-of-state properties approached us and sought an option to purchase the property at the end of their lease period, and we accepted that option. So we are willing to sell the properties for appropriate terms. That property, one of our properties, may well sell in a few years at the tenant's option, and we'll be willing to do that if that occurs.
And then, Mr. Abbott, if I have any questions after taking a look at the newer audit work, I'll contact your office and we'll deal with whatever issues may come up. But it's nice to have a update on that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm well aware that you're familiar with how to reach me on these issues.
And I'd like the record to reflect that Co-Chair Senator Von Imhoff has arrived. Go ahead and continue on. On slide six.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the funds that we talked about in terms of how we generate them, here is the trustees' recommendation for how they will be deployed in FY21. I'm going to start sort of at about 1 o'clock on the slide and work my way through clockwise. The orange and yellow wedges are the admin budgets for both the Trust Authority and the Trust Land Office shops. And I want to call your attention to that because I want to highlight the fact that our total admin budget for FY21 is less than our admin budgets for FY20. We are consistently working to drive down our admin spending and drive up our programmatic spending. And as a percentage of our overall activity, you will continue to see that ratio move in the right direction. Our total spending will grow. Our admin spending, I can't promise you that it won't, that it will be reduced year after year, but I can commit that it will grow less quickly than our programmatic spending. And so over time, you will see the green and the blue wedges grow and the orange and the yellow wedges shrink as a representation of the ratios of our total spending. And we're working with the revenue subcommittee and the DNR subcommittee on both of those admin budgets, which do require appropriations from the legislature. The next wedge, the green wedge, is the one that is described with one of our terrible acronyms, known only to a few people, most of which are in this room, Mental Health Trust Authority Authorized Receipts. These are the funds that the trustees deploy to be spent inside state agencies. So these funds do show up either in the operating budget or the mental health trust budget or the capital budget as authorized receipts. And we need the legislature to appropriate the receipt authority so that we can then fund these activities. And then the blue wedge, the largest of the wedges, is what we call authority grants. These are the grants that we make to nonprofits, tribes, local governments, and other non-state agencies. And these funds don't go through the legislature or your processes at all. These are funds that are authorized to be granted by the trustees and then rolled out through several hundred different grants, including mini grants over the course of the fiscal year. And all of this is done through public processes at the trustee level or the staff level. We have more detail than I imagine you're interested in if you have specific questions about individual grants or work that we're doing in specific communities or with specific beneficiary types, we can certainly provide that at your convenience.
Okay. Any questions on this slide? Okay. Next slide, please.
So one of the trust's responsibilities as directed by the settlement, in addition to spending the trust's own money, the trust also makes recommendations for the deployment of general funds. And as I said before, some of these are capital items, some of these are in the mental health budget, and some of these are in the operating budget. The blue columns indicate the trustees' recommendations for GFMH, and I know this committee is well aware of this, GFMH is just GF. It has the MH because it is sourced in a recommendation from the trust, but it is regular GF and counts and spends just like GF does in your books. I'd love to say that there's a different pot of money that this is drawn from, but that is not the case. As you can see on this list, there were several items that the trust recommended that were not included in the governor's budget. We're not planning to go through these in detail with you today, but we will be working with the Finance Committee, the relevant subcommittees, to talk about these and likely to encourage you to consider funding some or all of the GF portions of these budget lines. So happy to answer any questions on these. Wasn't planning to go through these line by line, but did want to give you a sense that there are several of these items that we will be talking to you about in coming weeks.
Okay. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. What's your total liability on deferred maintenance?
This is a deferred maintenance program that is run by a state agency. We contribute to this. And then the agency does a competitive process to identify grantees. So this is not the state's deferred maintenance list, and we have not captured the universe of potential deferred maintenance requirements or obligations that are out there. These are not funds that would be used on the trust's facilities or the trust's operations. These are funds that would be granted And this 50-50 arrangement that the trustees have recommended is one that has lived in the state program for more than a decade, maybe longer than that.
So is this public facilities at DOT you're dealing with?
No. These are likely to be more, these are commonly facilities, nonprofits, or other agencies that have deferred maintenance requirements. Typically, okay. These grants are relatively small, in the $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 range individually. And yeah. Typically, there's $500,000.
I had it backwards. I had the flow of the funds backwards, so the question was directed to, should have been directed to the other side. So,
just a follow-up. Thanks for the answer, but just a follow-up would be kind of nice in the world that we all work in here on this to see what the target might be. That might be something the board might want to tackle. Thanks.
Okay. Thank
you, Chairman. We have other questions on this slide? Okay. Go on to the next slide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Want to give you a little bit of an update on activity at the Trust Land Office. You can see in the table on the right, the Trust Land Office will generate, this is based on FY19 activity, it generated about $10.5 million. I want to highlight, that is a combination of the revenues that we generate that are what we categorize as investable versus spendable. In this case, in this year, roughly half of the $10 million that was earned in revenue by the Trust Land Office is required to be invested. The way we earn it, by the sale of a piece of property or in a royalty from a mineral or oil and gas, a portion of the timber sale, we dedicate that to be invested because those are likely to be one-time earnings from that land asset. We're only going to sell a piece of land once. So once we've sold that, we then invest the proceeds from that sale permanently. And we would only spend the investment earnings off of that contribution and not the contribution itself. The other portion of the TLO revenue is what we call spendable. These are the recurring revenues from lands. We have land leases. We have permitting revenue. We grant a variety of short-term easements, and we find some of the land sales that we go through, we actually self-finance. The interest earnings from that financing activity are considered spendable. So the Trust Land Office has two different revenue streams. They add up to $10.6 million in FY19, but some of that is spendable. You saw that in our FY21 revenue stream. Some of it is invested into our corpus and is never touched again, although it earns interest or earns investment earnings that we largely live on. So a couple of important Trust Land Office activities that are ongoing right now. I mentioned the subport sale, a $20 million sale. Norwegian Cruise Lines is paying that off in roughly $5 million increments on a quarterly basis. So we've received $10 million to date. We expect to receive the balance by, I believe, September of 2020. At which point that $20 million will be deposited into the corpus of the Mental Health Trust Fund and will begin to earn interest for us. We use a percent of market value to generate our investment earnings. We use a 4.25% payout rate. So just to give you a sense of the scale of that, so when that $20 million is deposited, it will ultimately earn $850,000 for us every year forever. That's the way it will work for us. So that's the impact of a $20 million deposit. In most years, we are depositing between $10 and $20 million a year from land office activity into the Mental Health Trust Fund or our corpus. So that is one of the ways that we can anticipate continued income growth in our activity. I also mentioned, our chairman mentioned the Forest Service land exchange. We're in the final stages of that. I think I said the exact same thing last year, so I would understand some level of skepticism with that. We're somewhat at the mercy of the Forest Service and their processes on this. We are making significant progress. We have already received what we call phase one, which is lands on Prince of Wales Island that were originally part of the Tongass National Forest. Those lands have been transferred to the Mental Health Trust in exchange for trust lands above the city, the community of Ketchikan. The lands that the trust acquired in the portion of the Prince of Wales Island known as Naugatty are already under contract for timber harvest and are actually being harvested. Actually, we were eager enough to get them going, and the market was eager enough to bid for these lands that we actually contracted for the timber sale before we controlled the acreage. We knew what we were going to get. It was just a question of timing of a difficult federal process. There was logging going on this land within a few weeks of it being officially transferred to the trust. And you will continue to see timber revenues to the trust going forward. In fact, timber revenues will likely be one of our largest revenue categories for the next several years. The second phase of the land exchange is underway right now, or is in process. That will allow us to transfer additional currently trust lands. There's more land near Ketchikan and on Gravina Island, land near and above Petersburg and Wrangell, Sitka and Juneau as well, will ultimately be transferred to the Tongass National Forest. In exchange, the trust will receive additional lands, most of it on Prince of Wales Island. What lands we acquire, we expect to utilize primarily for timber harvest going forward. I hope that because I know I'll come back to see you again next year, Mr. Chairman, looking forward to it already. I hope I can tell you at that point that the sale is either completed or about to be completed at that time. Mr. Chairman, you were interested, and I'm happy to give you an update on the trust's development at Icy Cape. This is a large parcel of trust land on the very northern part of the Gulf of Alaska, roughly between Prince William Sound and the community of Yakutat. The trust owns a lot of land there, and it has a couple of different values that we're currently working. Right now, there's an active timber sale. Sea Alaska Timber is harvesting on trust land right now. We're being challenged by difficult timber markets. We're not sure that we're actually going to harvest all of the timber that is available right now, primarily due to market conditions. But Sea Alaska has been an excellent partner and has been logging for a couple of years now on that site. We also have an active mineral exploration program underway at Icy Cape. On the beach and the uplands, there is a significant gold deposit, and there is also a interesting and somewhat unusual concentration of industrial abrasive materials. These are garnets and other similar types of very hard sands, typically. And there is a market for these for industrial uses. So the trust has completed a fourth year of field work on that site. And we're currently evaluating the quality of the samples that were obtained. And we will be looking for ways to advance that, the development of that prospect, later in 2020. And again, happy to report back to you next year on our progress related to that. This is likely to be a significant revenue generator for the trust in coming years. But it's likely five or more years away from generating revenues.
Yes, that's why I mentioned it earlier in the presentation, Icy Cape, because of the prospectivity of that holding. It's a very attractive as far as revenue generation.
It is one of we have a few sort of mining exploration projects underway. Icy Cape is among the most promising of those.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the Trust Land Office, how many employees do you have, and where are they located?
There are 17 Trust Land Office employees, and then one vacancy that's being actively recruited for right now. All but one of them are in Anchorage. The other one is in Ketchikan and runs our timber program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions on this one? Okay, next slide, please.
So a little bit more about our spending. Mary Jane described our 25 years of work. I don't need to go into great detail on these, but just some of the highlights of what the Trust has been able to help accomplish. And I would suggest that in many cases, the Trust's contributions, both in the term of funding and advocacy and, you know, Jeff Jesse just being a pain in the butt, made a huge difference in accomplishing several of these important public policy changes over the last 25 years. Harborview's closure in Valdez, the development of mental health courts, the whole Bring the Kids Home initiative, and then more recently, Medicaid reform and expansion. So these are examples of things that the Trust has been able to help the state accomplish in the last 25 years. Just a little bit more on Medicaid, since that's a little bit of an issue of the moment. I think all of you were around working on SB 74 a couple of years ago. The Trust was a key part of that, and the Trust made at that time a $10 million multi-year commitment to fund most of the, I'll call them one-time or startup expenses associated with Medicaid reform and expansion. The Trust has met that obligation. By the end of FY20, the current year, that $10 million will be fully expended. It's taken a little bit longer to get Medicaid reform online, but we're grateful to say that most of the key elements of Medicaid reform, as they relate to the Trust beneficiaries in particular, are now online and beginning to bear fruit for Trust beneficiaries and for Alaskans generally. Some of those highlights are the Administrative Services Organization, which will essentially be a managed care operation for behavioral health and Medicaid. That's a big change and one that's important. The other important change in Medicaid reform as it relates to behavioral health is the so-called 1115 waiver, which will expand the number and quality of services of behavioral health services available in Alaska, specifically for substance abuse treatment. So whereas in the past, Medicaid was a very limited funder of behavioral health and substance abuse treatment, that will be dramatically expanded. And all credit to the department for its diligent pursuit of very difficult bureaucratic work in order to bring this program online. And we're grateful to have been a funding partner and an advocate for this. We think Medicaid reform and expansion has been a big success. This is all information that is generated by the department. Most of it comes from the most recent Medicaid reform update that the department produced just a couple of months ago. You can see in the graph in the lower right, the green bar represents the number of Alaskans that have been served by Medicaid. And you can see that roughly 100,000 additional Alaskans have been or are being served by Medicaid now as opposed to about 5 or 6 years ago. And obviously then Medicaid total spending has gone up, but state general fund spending has not. So we've served essentially an extra 100,000 Alaskans with, as the report described, flat state contributions over that time frame. We believe that is an amazing success story, and we're grateful to the legislature and the department for having pursued reform and expansion activity to make this sort of display possible. We expect that ongoing Medicaid reform activities, and I know this committee is very interested in those, we'll be talking to the department about their plans for that, will continue to improve service and hopefully reduce spending as well. And the trust will continue to be a partner in that. We recognize that Medicaid reform has not made every provider happy. There are lots of providers that don't expect to thrive on a Medicaid-based system and would prefer to stay with state grants as one of the primary funding tools for Medicaid-type services and specifically related to substance abuse and behavioral health. But we understand that the bargain, if you will, that was struck in SB 74 is that grants will decrease as Medicaid spending for like services increases. And that should be good for the state budget because the Medicaid expenditures will be primarily funded by the feds, whereas the old grant system was entirely general funds. We have been concerned that the timing of the Medicaid funding hasn't always matched the timing of the reductions in the grant funding, but we do understand that grant funding will go down and should go down as Medicaid funding becomes available for providers. So I want folks to understand that the trust is capable of being a part of this process and sort of keeping our end of the bargain on this and working to help the state reduce its general fund contribution to these services.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Yeah, I was pretty sure I wouldn't get away with
that. No, we got a couple too. So, Senator Olson, you have a question also? Okay, we'll go to Senator Von Imhoff and Senator Olson.
Thank you. So we've seen this graph here in several different iterations, and I think the important thing is to analyze the many different ways that graph could look in the future beyond 2019 that you have there. Definitely interested in the 115 waiver recently, especially for behavioral health. But the conversations that we're having with some of the HESS folks is that it's a complicated mixed bag, because with the so many different categories, some are reimbursed at 50%, some more than that. So it depends on how many people are seeking these services in which particular buckets will determine whether there's going to be more state funding on our end for this particular category. And so to say that we're going to lead to continued savings, I think maybe not. And so I think it's just important to kind of have an acknowledgement that it is very complicated and that we could very well see not savings in the future. And then my last comment will be, if that is the case, what's being done to manage the different levers of state funding, federal funding, usage, and so forth going forward, so we don't start seeing a bigger spike in the pink bar?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Von Imhoff, I think what we would hope over time is that the green bar, or the green line, actually turns down. That means, frankly, people are making more money, and they're not, that they're earning more, and they're not then eligible for Medicaid, and because they're have access to health care through different systems. But we agree entirely that Medicaid is a difficult to manage enterprise. We create a list of services, we create a reimbursement rates, and then we lose control of them at that point. If people show up and need those services and the providers bill at those rates, then the program is on the hook, and different levels of federal contribution come into play for different service types. The 1115 waiver is based, obviously, on an expectation that the new service types and reimbursement rates that are now allowable will be less expensive to the Medicaid program generally than the pre-existing Medicaid system would have been. The notion being that by dealing with substance abuse and other behavioral health issues earlier and less intensively, that you will avoid requirements for acute care, hospitalization, et cetera. That is the high-level expectation of this arrangement. And other states have demonstrated, other states are ahead of us, and several have demonstrated that this can work. Obviously, Alaska has, and our healthcare system in particular, doesn't have as much in common with other states as we might, you know, as we might hope, just for the purposes of comparisons. But we are committed to this test, to this trial, which is what the 1115 waiver is, and working with the department to increase access to services. And work to secure the savings that we would expect based on the analysis that's been done. But it is not a guarantee.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Abbott, as you look, I want to congratulate you, first of all, for in the program for providing health care to those people that weren't eligible or didn't weren't being serviced by the program. But as I look at, as was talked about, we're interested in funding, and the second bullet point talked about the flat state GF spending. Is that all undesignated, all UGF, or is there some designated funds that are there as well?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't know. This is from the department's report, and I'm sure somebody knows the answer to that.
Sure.
But it's not me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One of the, I guess, your mere successes and happiness sometimes brings indigestion to the table when we struggle with our budgets, because we've gone from roughly 17% of our population to 35%, and we in Medicare and Medicaid combo, and we have tried to we tried to reduce it last year by roughly $70 million, and the governor added another 50 for 120. I'm expecting in the immediate future, tomorrow or Monday, the governor will put a supplemental on the table which could exceed that. Could be 120 or even 130 from what I heard. And we'll see what his numbers actually are when they're on the table. But what that means, we basically put a lot of effort in trying to control this in last year's budget, both the legislature and the executive branch, and we come up in the same spot within 6 months. So we do have some challenges here in this component of our operating budget. Senator Von Imhoff has worked very hard, put a lot of time in last year, and I would expect there will be a thorough scrubbing this winter. And I hope as we go forward into next January, all our work doesn't get evaporated in 6 months again. So we're going to work on that with the department to see what we can do. So it is alarming with 35% of the population on financial assistance in the state. And I think it's probably one of the larger percentages of all the states, I would expect, and significantly larger than the national average. So I just thought I'd, you know, kind of tease you about your success with my indigestion sometimes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've said it many times at this table, and when we were going through the budget on the HESS budget, the way to control it is to look at the services. The services, you know, that's a difficult task, but the services in the last 10 years or 20 years, in fact, have been increasing, and there has been no look at trying to reduce those. And from my viewpoint, the only way to control this budget, if or reduce it if the legislature wants to, is to give a serious look at the services that are being provided.
I would agree with that, and so we'll be working on that issue to change some of the requirements, if at all politically possible. Any other questions on the success of slide number 11? Thank you.
I think I need to move on to things that aren't successful yet. Might be a more comfortable conversation, apparently. Mary Jane mentioned that one of our next opportunities is another serious challenge that the state faces, another opportunity for the trust to be both a funder and a convener and an advocate. There is right now, and we see this in a number of forms, essentially a failure of our ability to serve Alaskans dealing with psychiatric crises. And these crises come in many forms, substance abuse related, mental health related. There's any number of types and any number of causes for this. But what we know through a variety of obvious and empirical sources is that we are not addressing this need. We are not addressing the need properly. And so the need is being addressed improperly. And by that I mean we are overburdening our first responders, our hospitals, our correctional system, API, and then Alaskan families, Alaskan employers, churches. Everybody in Alaska is dealing with this because we do not have systems in place to deal with it more productively. And so we, and all credit to the state and the department for sharing this recognition, we have been looking for other ways that other places have done a better job of this. And we have identified one model in particular that is, we believe, is able to help us address what we are doing such a terrible job of here in Alaska. The model is described as the Crisis Now model. And if Senator Wilson were here, he could tell you a lot about it. He traveled to Maricopa County, Phoenix metro area, late last year with a group of other Alaskans, including trust staff, Representative Johnston from the House, Deputy Commissioner Al Wall, leadership from the Anchorage Police Department, and others, to watch this in action. And then subsequent to that, the trust funded another field trip, which included 25 Alaskans, department staff, and other key stakeholders to go and again see what's going on in Phoenix. What they are able to do is to radically improve the success of the folks that are experiencing crisis and reduce the impact on the rest of the community associated with that. And they have done it in a system that pays for itself for the most part, and primarily through Medicaid and other forms of health care funding, private pay, private insurance, self-pay, etc. And they have done it by standing up a system of crisis care that includes call centers where folks can folks in crisis, their families, their coworkers, first responders can call to get support for those individuals. And the calls are taken 24/7 from throughout the region that's being served. the vast majority of calls result in the crisis being alleviated without further support. So in other words, on the call itself, there are clinicians and other highly trained caregivers that can support the individual, their family, whoever's around them in the moment and help them address their situation. Where that service is not enough support, they also have developed what they call mobile crisis teams. These are two-person teams that, as their name suggests, are mobile responders. In the Phoenix area, they have robust 24/7 coverage, and they are able to get to the scene of a crisis in 20 minutes or less, 90% of the time. These teams are made up of typically a master's level clinician and what we call a peer support staffer. This is typically someone with some lived experience in this world, often someone in recovery from substance abuse or other mental illness treatment. These two-person teams, they go to the crisis. Whether it's a street corner, whether it's a workplace, a home, a church, a school, lots of these responses are in schools. It's not just adults that experience these crises. And they, typically, a first responder will already be there. The first thing they do is, once everybody is safe, is they kick the first responder out, which serves two benefits. First, the first responder gets to go and deal with likely a more pressing situation. Second, it's oftentimes the first responders themselves that are accelerating these crises. And you can frequently de-escalate the situation just by getting the man or woman with a gun and the flashing lights and the sirens and the driveway and all the drama associated with a police or fire response and getting that out of there and giving these mobile crisis teams a chance to do their work. That they deal on site, the majority of the responses they make fully address the situation. The third level of response required, when a mobile crisis team response is not successful, is what we call short-term subacute or residential. And I know I'm using a lot of code words. Dr. Olson knows what I'm talking about. But this means something a little less than a hospital, but a little more than what you can get in your own home or in a doctor's office, a clinic style. So these are drop-off centers, they can be walk-in centers, and they provide either, or typically both, 23-hour non-residential services or short-term residential services. And these are facilities that are typically operated by nonprofit entities that provide services for folks that need to be somewhere other than where they would otherwise have access to. These are not hospitals. These are not emergency rooms. These are typically, as I said, subacute care facilities. If you walked into one, as I did in Phoenix a month ago, it looks like a place with it looks like a living room. It's got recliners. It's got televisions. And it's staffed by clinicians, and it's helping people just sort of stabilize themselves so that they can then receive treatment or care. Or go back, to get back on their meds or get off their meds or whatever, and then get right. And then they're typically excused, and back they go into the community. We don't have any of these three systems in place right now in Alaska. We have sort of small parts of some of them, but there's certainly no systemized effort to do this. And what Phoenix has learned is that you need all three of them in place if possible, and so that they can complement each other. Phoenix is obviously a different place than Alaska. the density of population, the scale that they're able to do is obviously different and is not what we could replicate. But we can learn extensively from this, and we can apply some or all of these services throughout the state. We may not be able to have every service in every community. In fact, we certainly would not. But some of these elements can serve every community in the state. And we would be and are committed to investigating this, to finding out how much of this is possible. So we hired the entity that built this system in Maricopa County. They are consulting with us. They came to Alaska last fall. They spent 2 weeks in Matsuin, Anchorage. They spent a week in Fairbanks. They met with all of the stakeholders, dozens and dozens of stakeholders in all of those communities, to find out what is needed in each of these service types in those areas. They produced a report, which is available on our website, and has been shared with stakeholders across Alaska. And we are committed to testing the viability of this in Alaska. I want to make sure you hear from me right now. We are not asking for any general funds for this at this time, and hopefully not ever. The trust later today will consider a multi-million-dollar, multi-year funding commitment to the startup expenses, initially for the planning for, and hopefully for the startup expenses of some or all of these service types in Alaska immediately. Hopefully some of this can begin within a year. And I don't, please don't hear that as a commitment, but we need this desperately right now, and we are committed to working on it. And we don't want any of your money right now. Medicaid will ultimately pay for a lot of these services. I'm not suggesting there is not a state funding role in this, but it will not. I'm not asking for a GF grant today to test this. The trust, and I'm saying this, I'm sort of betting on the come a little bit here, because the trustees have not yet endorsed this. They will have the opportunity to do so later today. But I'm optimistic that the trust will commit itself to working on this. And as I said, Senator Wilson, Representative Johnston, other legislators have expressed interest in this. We want people to see this at work, whether it's in Phoenix or it's elements of this are at work in communities around the country. Alaska is not different in the need for this than other places. So we are working on this. This, I think for the trust, this is our next big thing.
You can come forward in a year and give us an update next year's presentation. And
I hope we'll be sharing this with interested members long before that.
Okay. Senator Bishop, then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Mr. Abbott, this Phoenix model, how long has it been in place, and have they been in place long enough they have enough data that they can benchmark to what it saved their emergency responders, ER visits, et cetera, et cetera?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bishop, thank you very much. They have been operating for more than 10 years, I think probably closer to 12 years. They have tremendous data, and they're and I'm going to look over my shoulder here and hope that one of our staff members can recall. It's certainly available in the report, that, and I'll follow up with you if I don't know it. The amount of police officer savings in time associated with this. I'll just give you one example of how that expresses itself. In this drop-off center, this receiving center, the typical police officer time spent to do the handoff, taking someone from the back of their car and admitting them, if you will, that's the wrong term, but getting them into the receiving center, is a minute and a half. It is literally a warm handoff. The police officer shows up, introduces the guest, which is how they are thought of by this receiving center. And it's a person in crisis. This is likely to be a difficult person. Introduces them to the receiving center. Here's his name. Here's a little bit about him. There's no weapons. go through some very high-level safety issues, and then the police officer is excused. Again, the receiving center does not want to be a part. They don't want first responders to be there. It does not help their guests at this point. So
that's fine. You could get back to the committee on some of that data. Let's Mr. Abbott. Yeah, we're not going to operate like that here in the room.
It's an impressive number.
Yeah.
So I apologize. I didn't have it at hand. But there's a tremendous amount of data in Phoenix. The system essentially pays for itself. There are there's no supplemental state funding provided for this. It is primarily paid for through the same way that other health care is paid for.
So you could get back. You can get back to the committee on Senator Bishop's question in more detail, but I don't want to stop the meetings and have conversations back in the audience. We don't operate like that here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at the homeless population here in the state of Alaska, that's becoming more and more of a problem. And many of those people have got mental health issues, behavioral problems, and those kind. Are you seeing this as a help in trying to just deal with the homeless problem we have here in the state of Alaska, which is different than the homeless population that's there in Arizona? And so how do you anticipate that's going to happen if it is?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we would expect this to have a significant, make a significant improvement in the quality of care available to folks that are experiencing homelessness in Alaska. As you suggest, a very significant percentage of Alaskans in homeless situations are challenged by a lack of or a weakness in a combination of substance abuse treatment, mental behavioral health care, et cetera. And a significant percentage of the current first responder calls, emergency room visits associated with psychiatric crisis are experienced by Alaskans with homelessness. And this will radically improve the quality of care available to those folks and make it possible for them to contemplate life other than a homeless existence. This doesn't provide housing. Sure. I'm not suggesting that. But one of the barriers to housing is people's ability to address their behavioral health or substance abuse challenges. And if we treat that, we are confident, and we've learned this from other places, that people will seek housing when they are capable of, when they have addressed, at least in part, substance abuse or mental health challenges.
Sure. Okay. We have any questions on this slide?
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
You have a follow-up?
Yes. First of all, the first responders and getting them out of the situation immediately, I think, is a good reason, because they are escalators at times and they tend to burn out real quickly. But the question I have is, you made the comment that Medicaid will pay for these services that are there. Since we're at the finance table, one of the concerns we have, will they pay for it in full or just partially pay for it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, in terms of reimbursement rates and that, I do not know the answer to that yet. But I do know that the 1115 waiver process that we discussed a few minutes ago contemplates several of these service types. So I don't know specifically what the reimbursement rates are versus the provider actual costs. That's a fair question, and it'd be a great question for the department at some point. But I do know that in Arizona and in other jurisdictions that are using some or all of these service types, that Medicaid is a key payer, and it is ultimately reducing overall Medicaid expense, because these are folks that would otherwise be in hospitals.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions on this slide before we jump to the next one? Okay, next slide, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I've sort of jumped through a couple of slides here related to this crisis now and the opportunities for improvement in this area. And I've even covered a little bit of next steps. The trustees later today will have the opportunity to bless additions to our FY21 trust budget that will fund areas necessary to advance the planning for this, and assuming that the planning suggests that this is a good idea, and I think that is highly likely, than to actually fund operational implementation.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, that concludes our presentation. Happy to answer questions. We've tried to focus on one of our sort of programmatic areas that I think is a subject of some interest, but there's a lot of other areas that we're working in, and we're happy to talk about those at the committee's convenience.
Okay, thank you. Any final questions for the chairman or the head of the mental health? Okay, seeing none, that'll conclude the presentation and labor today at the committee. Tomorrow, we're going to have the permanent fund in front of us, and we're going to talk about the corpus of the permanent fund, the growth, the earnings reserve, the survivability of the earnings reserve, dividend options, all kinds of interesting subject matters revolve around the permanent fund. So we look forward to that. That'll be tomorrow. I would like to thank the Board of the Mental Health for coming today and other support personnel, and we'll get back to the mental health group after they respond to the questions today. And if we have any budget questions and stuff, we have a good working relationship with them, and we'll go forward and try to help them enhance the value of their holdings and so they can produce services to the citizens of the state. And thank you for coming. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since I'm the only one at this table probably that worked on the legislation with Jeff Jesse, I think the success of the program has far exceeded the expectations of those that worked on the legislation, and I would commend the board and the management for that success.
Thank you. That we are adjourned.